Good morning, everyone. Let's see if things will do better tomorrow this morning than they did on Wednesday night. If you weren't here, we had a lot of technical difficulties, but we managed to get through it, and so I think we will this morning as well. Our topic this morning is going to be how we got the Bible. So we won't be doing as much reading in the Bible as we normally do during lessons, but it's a topic that was suggested to me. Someone was interested in this, and I think it's something that we need to know a little bit about. One of the things that we will confront in the world today are those skeptics who ask the question of how do you even know that what you have, this book that's in front of you, is in fact God's Word? How do you know that we have the things that were written down that God wanted us to have? And so we're going to go through a little bit of that this morning. If you're visiting with us, thank you for coming. We have a few visitors. We're glad for your presence. Hope that you'll stick around for a minute or two and say hello as we go on. But as we get right into it this morning, I do have to caution you. I'm only going to be able to hit some highlights this morning. We're going to kind of go from end to end. And if you've got more questions than this answers, please feel free to ask me. We could do a lot more studying on this. But I felt like if we got a good overall picture this morning, it might help us understand just where we got this marvelous book. So as we start looking at what do we mean by the Bible, well, a lot of people don't realize when you're first starting to talk to them, most of us take it for granted, that it's really 66 different books. It's not just one coherent book. It's not like one author sat down. And in fact, in the Old Testament, you've got 39 different books, and it's probably at least 28 authors. There's enough anonymous sections and places and Psalms where it talks about who wrote some things there that we don't really know the exact number of authors. In fact, there's some books where we don't know who the author is in the Old Testament, and that might be a problem to some, but we'll talk about how we get past some of those things. The New Testament is a little different in terms of how we get things put together. There's 27 different books. We know that there are 8 authors in the New Testament. It was written in Greek, whereas the Old Testament is mostly in Hebrew. And that might present a problem to some people because I don't speak Hebrew and I don't speak Greek. I don't know either of those languages, and I dare say I don't think many of us in this audience would know them as well. So when we start talking about the Bible that we use, we typically have an English translation. Or if you're in another country, you're going to have a different translation. My son-in-law, a few years ago, as many of you know, I've done some traveling to like Korea, and he found in a used bookstore a really neat Bible that's got, it's Korean on one side and English on the other. And that's kind of a handy thing, and I would carry it with me more over there if it weren't so large and weighed 70 pounds and would take up half my luggage. But it's the kind of thing where we look at, and there's lots of translations. So how do we go through these? And we also have to remember that the Bible wasn't written all at once. If you consider that Moses probably started the first bits in about 1400 B.C., and that the last close of the New Testament scriptures were somewhere in the 90s A.D., that's almost a 1,500-year span. And right in the middle there, there's this year from about 400 B.C. up until the writings of about 45 when they started putting things, where there was nothing. It was just an what we call the era of silence in terms of God's communication. Now, what we have to do is establish the path. What are we going to talk about? How are we going to address this issue of getting the Bible? And what I want to do is talk a little bit about the process, because I think this is important that we understand the concepts here. Because we talk about the Bible being perfect. And as we're going to cover this morning, and as we'll discover, the texts that we have of the Bible are not perfect. And so we'll have to deal with that issue. It starts with God. God having a message that he wants to give to man. And when God decided to give that message, he picked individuals, those who were going to be the authors, and he revealed that message to them. Now, those people were inspired men, the prophets, the apostles, those who took up their pen at the direction of God and wrote things down. Now, what we call that is an autograph. If you look in any of the literature about this kind of study, the autograph is, we think of autograph as, you know, what you would sign, right? Well, that's essentially what it means. That would have been the copy that the original author would have signed. And so you can imagine, you know, somebody like Paul, you know, when he comes down to the end of his letter and he says, I, Paul, you know, have written this in my own hand. So that would have been a signature there. And these men wrote these things down, but we don't have any of those. We have none of the original documents that were written by these men. Now, I don't know about you, but I think about this sometimes, and I'm wondering if, you know, 200 years down the line, where one of the original recipients, the great-grandson of one of the original recipients of Paul's letter is going, man, I wish Dad hadn't burned that thing. I could tell you a long story, but it just I had an experience similar. My great-grandfather had a trunk with old letters and things in that that we used to play in when I was a kid. He used to let us go play in his steamer trunk. Everybody know what a steamer trunk is? You know, those old wooden things with a dome lid and all? And he had deeds written on like the back of envelopes and letters that dated back to the Civil War. And when they passed away, when my great-grandparents passed away, the great-grandkids descended upon this at the funeral, where's the steamer trunk? Because that's where we were going to get some memories. And my grandmother at the time said, oh, well, so-and-so, one of my uncles wanted it. So we gave it to him. Said, oh, great, where's all this inside? Oh, he didn't want any of that stuff. We burned it. He burned it all. And I don't know what happened to the autographs, but they're gone. And I wish we had them, but we don't. But here's what happened. Those autographs, when Paul would send a letter someplace, or when Moses wrote down all the books of the law, it talks about those people coming and people copying them. And those we call the scribes, their job was to copy it and disseminate it. Make copies and send them out. Those copies we call manuscripts. Now, the manuscript is a copy of all or part of this original document in the original language. That's an important point there, is they didn't translate them there. They were just copies. We've got over 5,000 manuscripts of just the New Testament. There are hundreds of thousands of partial bits and pieces of manuscripts from the Old and New Testament. It's in a tremendous wealth of material that's available. And those copies were copied and copied and copied. And then at some point, somebody decides, well, you know what? We need to have this book in a different language. And so other people get those copies, and they study them, and they translate them. So a translation is a version of the original, or the copied manuscript, but it's written in a different language. Now, here's the important point, folks. Keep in mind that the Bible, although it's been translated in hundreds of languages, and what you have here is that translation, it did not come from the original. But we need to understand two sections here. That first part, where God reveals all of this to people, that is the topic that we call inspiration. That is exactly the message that God wanted these people to have. You can look at that as like the miraculous side. But from there on down, it's preservation. And it's in the hands of men. Now, I sincerely believe that the providence of God has made sure that that information continued to flow through the ages. The Bible has been attacked at every point. And there's been times when people tried to destroy it, and it is still, even in this day and age, with all of the ungodly things going on in this world, the Bible is still the number one printed book in the world. And so you can't discount the providence of God in this, but it's not miraculous, and we have to understand that chain. Now, for this morning, I'm going to assume that God had a message and that he inspired these men and that they wrote those autographs. We'll talk maybe in another lesson about the whole concept of inspiration and what that means and how we can recognize it and some things like that. I want to talk about this preservation process this morning. So the first thing we need to understand is, under the Old Testament, until the early part of this century, there were people who even questioned something like this verse in Exodus 24, where it starts out and it says, then Moses came and recounted to the people all the words of the Lord and all of the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words of the Lord which he has spoken, we will do. And then what does it say? Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. He wrote it all down. There are people who say, Well, I'm sorry, just writing wasn't developed enough in 1450 BC for Moses to be able to write this down. Well, that question's been long since answered. Writing was well developed by then. And in fact, it's kind of interesting. You can't see a lot of this, but keep in mind, everybody's heard of Egyptian hieroglyphics, right? And that's kind of a pictograph kind of writing. The pyramids of Giza were old when Moses was there, okay? The time periods of a lot of this writing of the hieroglyphics and all was well established by the time of Moses. And you go, well, what did you do, write the Bible in hieroglyphics? No. That tablet next to it, that little brown thing, that's a Babylonian cuneiform tablet. This particular one is from a library that they found in Egypt. It's called the El Amarna tablets. And they are written in Babylonian cuneiform, which is cuneiform, which is a different style of writing. And they're letters from all of the outlying provinces of Egypt written to Pharaoh with all kinds of different exchanges. We need this, we want this, we're complaining about this, thank you for this, you know, that kind of stuff. And there's thousands of them. Most of it translated, you can find a lot of them online. They're pretty nondescript in terms of, you know, the messages that they have in them. But think about this for a second. This is right about the time of Moses. It means that not only was the Pharaoh familiar with hieroglyphics and had scribes who could do that, he had translators. He had people who were multilingual, and they were writing in several different kinds of styles during that time period. And so not only would Moses necessarily have been familiar with things like his royal training, giving him access to the scribes and knowing the hieroglyphics, but potentially, you know, cuneiform, potentially other forms of writing in that. Who knows how many languages he spoke? When you think about being raised in Egypt, his people being the Hebrews, escaping to his father-in-law, you think they all spoke the same language? Moses was probably multilingual. So yes, he was able to write these things down. So from there forward, there's no excuse. We understand that those people were able to write that down. Unfortunately, unlike these things, which are stone and clay and preserved well, the pieces that they wrote on quite often didn't preserve all well. Leather and papyrus and parchment and those kinds of things. That one on the right is still another one of my favorites. That's the Rosetta Stone from the British Library. British Museum. It's got three lines of text on it. Look it up on the web sometime. It's really neat. They didn't even understand hieroglyphics till they found this thing. And because it's gotten in Greek, and I forget what the middle language is, but the top one is in hieroglyphics, they had dictionaries back then, too, to look things up and to translate things. All right, so let's talk about Old Testament manuscripts. This is where we would have come into the picture with these scribes beginning to make copies. They're usually large scrolls. They're handwritten. They are on leather, papyrus, parchment. They were treated with great respect. And in fact, the delivery of a new scroll into a synagogue, even today, is cause for a party. Okay? There's a great celebration when the scroll is delivered. And there are a lot of laws and rules and regulations on exactly how those scrolls have to be written. And in fact, they are treated with such great respect that when they start getting worn. Anybody ever had a worn Bible? I recently had to sort of put one of mine aside. It was sad. It's still on my dresser, but it doesn't have leather covers anymore because they kind of came off and the binding is now all strings and stuff. And I can't just bear to get rid of it yet, right? I might need some of my notes that were written in it at some point. And I did get a new one, okay, so I'm doing better. When they got worn and worn out, they buried them. You see, almost like you would respectfully bury a person who has deceased, they buried the scroll. Now, what do you think taking a leather scroll and burying it with great respect does for its long-term viability for archaeologists? We got a problem there, right? And for a long time, there weren't very many Old Testament scrolls. The Talmud actually records a lot of things about how to, they've got restrictions and all, and in fact, when you're copying it, there are people that are checking them, and if they make over two mistakes, in one column on a scroll, the scroll has to be destroyed. So those copyists are really careful because it can take months for an experienced scribe to create a scroll. So they were treated with great respect. They were the ones who then had that and going on. And here's something that, in understanding this whole concept of the transmission, you have to understand with them burying these scrolls, in recent history, before 1947, the oldest Hebrew manuscript we had was this thing called the Aleppo Codex, which was 920 A.D. Now, if Moses wrote the original in 1400 B.C., and this one was 900 A.D., 2,500 years separated from the original was the first copy that we had. And you might think, that's an awfully long time. And it is. The oldest Greek manuscripts were a little better, the 4th century A.D., about 400, but they're Greek. What does that mean about the Old Testament? They were actually translations. They weren't what we would call manuscripts of the original because they were in Greek, not Hebrew. But all that changed in 1947. In 1947, some Bedouin shepherd threw a rock in the wrong place and discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls. Everybody's heard of the Dead Sea Scrolls, right? And it's just a treasure trove of all of these ancient things. Somebody had squirreled away a boatload of these documents up in some caves in an area where it's really dry, instead of burying them, right? And they were preserved. And so suddenly, hundreds of years wiped away as we got scrolls of the Old Testament scriptures, over 200 of them from various books of the Old Testament. There are copies of every Old Testament book among the Dead Sea Scrolls except for Esther. Kind of interesting. Turns out there's rooms full of these things that were fragments. Maybe there was one there, we just didn't get that one or whatever. The absence of it doesn't really mean anything. But it was such a treasure trove. That one that I've got pictured there is the Isaiah Scrolls, a complete scroll of Isaiah. Now here's what's interesting about that. As they went through and they're studying this scroll. Now remember, this scroll probably dates to about 100 B.C. The oldest copy before this was 900 A.D. So there's 1,000 years difference between what they had and what they suddenly came into their hands. And when they reviewed it, when they went over and compared it, guess what they found? They were the same. In 1,000 years, only superficial, very minor differences. And we'll talk about some of those. All right, New Testament manuscripts. Now we're in sort of a modern area. The New Testament period, they used scrolls at first, but they kind of were smaller scrolls. During that time period, they were kind of squishing things down. I don't know if everybody had better eyesight, but they were writing in smaller letters, and the scrolls were shrinking down. Those big Torah scrolls, those things are heavy, and they're hard to carry around. They're not exactly your portable Bible, all right? And when you consider, and we'll talk about this a little more in a second, they had 22 of them in order to make up the entire scriptures. 22 scrolls. All right, that's a library all on its own in terms of what you got to have to preserve it. New Testament time, they're starting to get more portable. They're getting smaller. And in fact, they quickly changed over what they call a codex. Now, codex is, we call it a book, right? Codex is just a fancy word for early book. They were a lot cheaper to make. You know why? You can write on both sides. That seems like a strange innovation, doesn't it? It's almost like, you remember when copiers first came out that could print on both sides? It's like, oh, wow, we're getting close to the paperless office now. Yeah, that didn't work either. But you could save paper. Well, they could save parchment. And since parchment was expensive, you could half the cost. Still were copied, still handmade. And now we actually have this Codex Sinaiticus. It's really interesting. I gave you the website there. I'm going to put these notes on my website if anybody wants them later. But you can go online and look at photographs of this book, which dates back to the 4th century, okay, the 300s A.D., somewhere in that time frame. Here's a blow-up of the John, the first chapter, verses 1 and 2. I want you to notice a couple of interesting things about it. First, it's all uppercase. It's what we call unseal, okay? All uppercase letters. And do you see any spaces in there between words? Yeah, they didn't bother. And in fact, What they did was they just made the columns affixed width. They were one of the first to use this whole justified type. But they took it to an extreme. They didn't even hyphenate. If you came to the end of the line, and, you know, paper's expensive, so the spaces just get in the way. And you came to the end of the line, and you had spelled the first three letters of a six-letter word. Guess what you did? You just went down to the next line and put the next three letters there. So the words were split at random across the end of the lines and that kind of thing. But sometime, take a couple of sentences, take all the spaces out of it, and put it up there. And I was going to do that, but ran out of time last night. And you know what? You can still read it. You can take away all the punctuation and mostly still read it. And that's what they were doing here. So you got all kinds of things. And they started getting elaborate. There were times, this is from the Book of Kells. So is my tie. That's an illustration from the Book of Kells. That was preserved during the Middle Ages. You know, there were times when there was, you talk about the Dark Ages in Europe, when learning was going down and diseases were wiping out substantial portions of the populations, and the Viking raids were, you know, stealing and burning all the things over in Northern Europe. And yet you still find groups of typically monastic societies that would preserve these things. This particular book is just the four Gospels in Latin. The pages are about 12 inches by 14 inches. The beginnings of many of the pages are lavishly illustrated. And this one was dates from about 800 A.D., and they were making these copies even then. So the copy's been going on for a long time. One of the things we learned when we visited there was that they also made these things called pocket Gospels. Okay? Now, they were only 4 inches by 5 inches. They must have had really big pockets because they were also about that thick. But they were smaller. They were portable. And what they did was they would make these leather cases with a strap on it so that you could carry a part of the Bible with you. This was unheard of, the making them that portable and being able to carry them around. But you can see how much veneration over time people have put in these scriptures. So we've got a whole bunch of manuscripts. The only reason to put this table up is that this shows you that we've got a bunch of different manuscripts, some of them complete. These are the oldest ones that come in these areas. So when somebody wants to start studying and wants to start looking at, what do we have? Where did we get this material? Here you go, you know? A lot of older ones that are dated. But now as we start looking at the print version of the Bible, and, you know, kind of fast forward a little bit, this should ring a bell, right? The Gutenberg Bible, 1450s A.D., the first book mass-produced after they invented the printing press was the Bible. Mass-produced is an interesting word because they only made 180 copies, okay? But to them, that was mass-produced. You know, you got 180 copies in a very short period of time versus a year to make an entire copy before. Unfortunately, well, there's only 21 of them left in the world. But we do have 21 of them. And if you ever get to one of the museums around that has one, you can actually see one of the Gutenberg Bibles printed from way back then. So we go through, we've got manuscripts, we've got copies, we get all the way up to the printing age, and today we've got tons of stuff being printed. But how do we know which books to use? Now this is unfortunately a tough subject here that we're going to have to just hit highlights on, but we call it canonization. And there's some principles that I want you to understand first before we get into too many details here. First, canonical, what that means, all that means is if you hear somebody talking about the canon of the Bible, these are the books or the list of books that people recognize as being part of our Bible that are recognized as having divine authority. That's really all that means, is that people have now recognized that these books have divine authority. But please understand that a book first had divine authority. When God revealed his word and they wrote it down at that time, that book had authority. When they were circulating Paul's letters in the first century, those letters had authority because they were written by Paul. Do you see that? They didn't need somebody else, like a church council or anything, to decree that it had authority. What we needed is the books of, to understand is the books of the Bible possess their own authority. And as long before any church councils. So how did they figure this out? Well, what you have to do is you have to understand how you test a document. How do you look and see what's going on. And there's three things you have to look at. First of all, you have to look at the transmission. This is just a study of how did we get this text. And we've talked a little bit about that, and we'll talk just a little bit more in a second, so that we understand that the path by which we've gotten the text has some basis for believing that it is viable, that it is uninterrupted, that it is has been attention paid to things like accuracy. Then we're going to look at external evidence. We're going to look and see, did anybody else reference these texts? Did anybody else give us a clue, contemporaries especially, about what they believed these texts were and where they came from? And then you have to apply internal evidences. And we won't have time to look at a lot of these, but internal evidences, you're looking for historical accuracy, for consistency. You can look at things like fulfilled prophecy. There's all kinds of stuff you can look at inside of a book to see if it meets these tests, to see that if it has been preserved properly or if it is what it claims to be. Because that's the point there, is these books claim to be authoritative. If they are, in fact, the words that were written down for us, then they are authoritative, regardless of what any kind of church council says. Okay, so here's the picture that I want you to understand. Here's how it goes with manuscripts and transmission. Somebody wrote an original. Now, let's say that you were living in about the time of Isaiah, and maybe this is the Isaiah scroll. Don't take a lot of this too literally. I didn't try to get anything too accurate here. This is just conceptual, right? Isaiah writes everything down. Actually, he didn't write very much of it. He probably had a scribe, just like Baruch was Jeremiah's scribe or whatever. But as time went on, there were some scribes that went down and made copies. And I've just put three up here. I suspect there were a lot more copies made of those scrolls than just three, but this will do for an example. It's a little hard to see, but one of them's got an A and one of them's got a B on it and one of them's blank. Let's say that when the first scribe was copying it, or the first copy he made, he left out a letter somewhere, okay? Have you ever read in a book, be reading a book along, and all of a sudden you stop back and you realize that a word's misspelled? But yet you can still understand it there, right? Is a misspelling of a word a mistake that then says, this book's no good, obviously can't be valid? No, it's a misspelling. So let's say that one scribe introduces an A misspelling, and another scribe leaves out a word. He just kind of skipped over it when he was making his copy. Well, the next generation, these last for a while, they get buried. Next generation comes along, and people make copies of those copies. Well, guess what happens with that misspelling? The next scribe, he just does the same thing, right? And he gets it right. Maybe he introduces another misspelling or something, but the guy that didn't make any, maybe that one goes on perfect, and this other one goes. And this goes on for generations, but at some point, they're all gone. I don't have the original. I don't have any of those older copies. And I come to my time. And finally, somebody goes to, you always hear about them digging up things in old monasteries. Folks, that happens. They go into these older monasteries someplace. There's one out in the desert in the Sinai Mountains where they had this treasure trove of stuff. And all the monks there had long since forgotten about it. You know, they're all stuck away someplace. They didn't care. And they get some historian that goes digging through it. And he goes, whoa, look what I found. It's a copy of a book. And this one dates to 600 A.D. And then maybe you find another one. And you know what? It's got a little difference there. And you find that spelling error. And maybe then you find an older one someplace else. And it's got a little different error. And then maybe you find one and it's different than those, but it matches up with the other two. And that's kind of what it was like with the Old Testament scriptures until they found the Dead Sea Scrolls. And now by looking at all of those things together, and you can just put hundreds up there, 5,000 up there, for just the New Testament alone, now you've got a picture of what that original looked like. And you can even trace back and figure out which ones were in the same lineage because they're carrying the same mistakes. And by comparing these things that came across different times and different copyists and different provenance in terms of the path by which we got them, and they're all alike except for a few trivial things. Yeah, this is a historian's dream because you can reconstruct it. You haven't lost it, even though there were mistakes in these things. So they're not perfect. There's many kinds of errors. Some of them have unintentional errors. They're things that people, misspelled or miscopied or left out. There are a few intentional things. There are some places where some scribes tried to correct something or tried to add something in. Some critics want to count up and say, well, in all of these manuscripts that we have, just in the New Testament, in the 5,000 manuscripts there, there are 200,000 errors. Well, that sounds like a big number, doesn't it? 200,000. Now, let me give you an example of how they count that. Let's say that we've got one misspelled word in John. And that same misspelling shows up in 4,000 manuscripts. They count that as 4,000 mistakes. And see, in my book, that's only one. It doesn't take many when you've got 5,000 manuscripts and you count them that way to get up to 200,000, right? And the vast majority of these things are exactly that. Very small things that have absolutely no impact on the meaning. Now, there are a few that are not trivial. We've got just a few minutes left. Please turn over to John, the 7th chapter. I want to point out something that you'll see and so that you'll understand it. Look over at John, the 7th chapter. And we're going to begin in verse 53. And depending on which translation you have, you'll probably see some brackets or maybe a side note or something like that, because the section from John 53 down to John 11, on the side of my New American Standard, it says, later manuscripts add the story of the adulterous woman, numbering it as John 7:53 to 8:11. What they mean by that, and there's some other references up there, we won't look at all of those. What they mean by that is, for a long time, the manuscripts that they had, these verses were in it, but then they found some earlier ones where it wasn't there. Now, when you start looking at that, you go, okay, now that's not a trivial thing. This is a list of 12 verses that appear in some manuscripts and not in others. Now, how do you figure this out? Well, one of the things that people do is they start looking at the dates, looking at that path that they went through, and try to decide whether the inclusion was the problem. Somebody wrote it in and it shouldn't have been there. Or whether somebody left it out, you know, when they were making their copy, which could have happened as well. Now, how do you make that decision? Well, in many cases, what you start looking at is just count them up, okay? How many of these manuscripts have it and how many don't? And how many have other errors? And so some of the ones, for example, where this is left out, have a lot of other mistakes too. Whereas some of the ones that have it in don't have as many mistakes. But even if you can't figure it out, folks, there's only a handful, a dozen or so, of things like this. And even if we cut all of the ones out that have any question, it would make zero impact on the message of the Bible. You see that? So these manuscripts may not be perfect, but because we have so many, and because we've got more than any other ancient text, and I could talk for 10 minutes on this, and I'm not going to, and you'll thank me for it later. The Bible is the best providenced and recorded book in the history of mankind, period. We can have confidence that the scripts that we have are accurate. Now, external evidence, and we're just going to spend just a couple of minutes on these. Paul made an interesting statement in Romans. Then what advantage is a Jew? Of what benefit is circumcision? It's great in every respect. First of all, that they were entrusted with the oracles of God. What does that mean? How did we get the Old Testament scriptures? It's because the Jews took absolutely great care in getting those things copied and making sure there weren't mistakes and in burying old ones and destroying ones that didn't have errors. Did you know that in the Old Testament manuscripts, there are far fewer problems than in the New Testament manuscripts? Far fewer, because the Jews were in charge of that. Do you know that Jesus quoted from every book in the Old Testament? Almost every book. There's some piece or quote from there. And we've got people like Josephus, who came along and he's a Jewish historian. He lived about the time of the New Testament history there. And he makes this statement where he's talking to people about his Jewish heritage and all that. We have not an innumerable multitude of books among us disagreeing from and contradicting one another as the Greeks have, but only 22 books. And you might think, wait a minute, we put 37 in the Old Testament up earlier, right? Well, another guy made the same kind of listed it as 22. You have to understand that the Old Testament was organized a little differently back then. We have a different organization. They had five books of Moses, and then they had this section they called the former prophets, where Judges and Ruth were kind of on the same scroll, okay? And then they had the later prophets, and Jeremiah and Lamentations were on the same scroll. And then the big one is, down at the bottom it says Book of 12. What do you think those are? What do we call those? Those are the minor prophets, right? So if you look at our organization, well, one little quote from Christ here, where he says, "Then all things which are written about in the law of Moses and the prophets and the Psalms." He's really talking about the three big divisions that they had in the Hebrew Bible. So even Jesus was recognizing this kind of division there. We reorganized it. We've split out the book of 12 into the minor prophets, the thing on the left. So that's where we get our books. We split up, you know, Judges and Ruth, and we split Jeremiah and Lamentation. That gets us up to our 26 books rather than the 36 books. Whatever. 39 books. Sorry, folks, the brain is going here, and I know yours is too. So we're gonna finish this up real quickly. When you start looking at the canon of the New Testament, I don't want to read all of these, but just be assured that there were people at that time, as early as the first century AD, who are making lists of which books they understood come from which apostles. And so when you have somebody who in 150 AD lists things out and says, "I know that this book was written by John and this was written by Peter," and they start quoting all of these things, that's external evidence that these letters were from those people. And so when we organize the New Testament, we organize it kind of like this. We've got our Gospels, and we've got a book of history, and then we've got the Pauline epistles and the general epistles and one apocalyptic book. All of those are well attested in this manuscript history. Just a really brief word on translations, because I know people will have that. It's like, is a translation okay? Can I use a translation? Do I have to go learn Hebrew and Greek? I hope not, because I think I'm in an age where I'm not going to learn Hebrew and Greek real easily. But even Jesus used a translation. The Septuagint, which was translated in about 200 B.C., was the translation of the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek. It was one of the most influential books in the world because it made the Old Testament scriptures available to everyone, because Greek at that time was the universal language, just like English is the universal language today. We're really fortunate that we only have to learn English. The rest of the world has to learn two languages. And that's what Greek was like. That's what the Septuagint was like. And so if you compare some of the quotes that Jesus had, have you ever looked and we say, and Jesus said, and it says that it's a quote from this verse, and you go back and you look at it and you go, wait a minute, they look different. They mean the same thing, but they look slightly different. Why? Because one was from the Septuagint and one was from the Hebrew. Okay. We've got a bunch of English translations. Which one do you want to use? Well, these are some major ones. Keep in mind that they have a span there. We'll spend more time on this later if somebody has questions on it. Here's the real thing, is when you look at these, they kind of go a range. There's a free paraphrase kind of thing. There's a sort of dynamic thought for thought kind of thing. And then there's formal equivalents where people try to get word for word. I prefer using the ones on, yes, the right side of that scale, because now you're closer to what the original language stated. But now they're still trying to do translations, and so use several. And then there are a couple that kind of, you know, straddle this a little bit. The new English translation that's come out on the net is really interesting, because in addition to the translation, they have about as big a volume of just notes from all the translators on where they had problems and what was going on. And so it's very interesting to read. You got a question on a passage? Look it up in several English translations. They're there. They're available. And in fact, the Bible's been translated into hundreds of languages, hardly a language on this planet. Many of you don't even have paper Bibles anymore. I know it's gotten to be, you know, where even when I go on a trip, I used to try to buy small Bibles to carry. This thing here, and I know you guys have phones and things on it, but I've got like 1,000 of my reference books on here. That's just really cool to be able to carry it with me on a trip with this kind of, you know, heft. Folks, it's an age where we've got greater access to all of this than we've ever had before. The provenance is right. How do we get it? If you want some more information, I highly recommend this little book. It's called How We Got the Bible by Neil Lightfoot. Don't confuse him with Gordon Lightfoot. It's not the same guy. The quantity and the quality of the manuscripts that we have is very high. We can be assured that we've got the right thing. The translators have plenty of stuff to work with to try to get the right message. There are differences in these manuscripts, but the vast majority of them actually are helpful because they help us trace the history when a lot of it's missing. There are a few intentional things, but you know what? Nothing that changes the meaning of the words that we have. So folks, these Old Testament texts that have few entries, the New Testament texts that have several, when you start even moving all of those out, and just don't worry about that, you see that marginal thing, fine, toss it away if you want to. You're still going to have plenty. You're still going to have exactly what you need. Now you see, God's hand is not so short that he can't make sure that we have exactly what we're supposed to have. Now, he had to do that with fallible people like us, but he did it. And he did it in a way that we can have confidence that this book is exactly the book we're supposed to have. Thank you for putting up with me. I'm sorry I went over just a little bit this morning. If you've got other questions, please let me know. And in fact, this was recommended. We had a couple of people that asked me to talk on this. If you've got other topics you want me to cover, please let me know, and I'll promise to go over time on them as well. If anyone is here and you're not a member of God's kingdom, we have an amazing book that we call the Bible that teaches us not only about God, but it teaches us what God wants us to do and how he wants us to live. And that's the real message that we want to get out of this, is what does that mean? How do we order our lives? And to begin that, you need to understand that you've got sin. You've been separated from God. You need to repent of that sin. You need to come back to him, be bound together with him through his word by at first taking him on baptism and becoming a member of his kingdom, becoming one of his children. After that, you got to study the book, but we can trust the book, and we'll help you here if we can. If there's anyone who's subject to the call of Christ, please come while together we stand and while we sing.